Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In the closing scene of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, newspaper editor Maxwell Scott and tells Senator Ransom Stoddard, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. Another day we can talk about whether that could ever be good advice, but on that day the biggest challenge to the newspaperman's maxim will be the story of John T. Scopes, of the trial of John T. Scopes for teaching the evolutionary origin of the human race in a public school in Dayton, Tennessee. Law professor Samuel Walker has called that trial one of the most famous courtroom battles in American history. In the 9 decades since the close of the trial, a distorted version of what happened there, the legend, has become Exhibit A in support of one of the persistent myths of the contemporary secular culture, the idea that there's a long-running war between science and religion. Popular historian Frederick Lewis Allen, in a book used in American college classrooms for decades, wrote that the Scopes trial dramatized one of the most momentous struggles of the age, the conflict between religion and science. No serious historian of science thinks that what I call the warfare thesis when I'm feeling ironic, or the warfare myth when I'm feeling frank, correctly characterizes a relationship between these two great aspects of human life and culture. It nevertheless remains a trope available not only to members of the League of Militant Atheists on the warpath, but to any lazy journalist in search of a lead. It's a volume, right? Back there? Okay, just wanted to be sure. The trial is now known to most Americans chiefly through the dramatic efforts of Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee, whose 1955 play, Inherit the Wind, was later made into a movie and has since been read, watched, or produced by countless classes of American high school students, not so much for its literary quality as for the insight it allegedly provides into the 1920s or into science and religion, or both. That was surely true once when I was growing up. Riley told me maybe it's not true anymore. Maybe younger people don't have this experience of this play, but it's, I think, not unknown. Anyway, Lawrence and Lee explicitly denied that their play is a history of the Scopes trial. Lawrence even denied that the play is about the relation between science and religion. Nevertheless, neither the publisher of the standard paperback edition nor the film studio responsible for turning the play into a movie paid any attention to the author's protestations. Random House referred to it on its Bantam Books paperback edition, which you can see here. Look at the top of the cover, referred to it as the tense drama of the most explosive trial of the century. United Artists advertised their new film with a poster announcing, "It's all about the fabulous monkey trial that rocked America." And so the play is etched into public consciousness, the image of Scopes as a courageous school teacher persecuted for teaching evolution in his classroom by the religious fanatics who inhabit the Bible Belt. The incident, thus understood, has become, in the words of liberal journalist Joseph Wood Crutch, who covered the trial for The Nation magazine in 1925, part of the folklore of liberalism. Today I want to do three things. First, I want to briefly tell the story of what happened in Dayton in 1925. Second, I want to identify the real antagonists in the conflict that underlay and that was the trial at Dayton. And finally, I want to say a few words about why I think all that matters today. So, the history of the trial, part one. Although the Scopes trial was in popular imagination the prosecution, if not the persecution, of a school teacher for the crime of teaching evolution, the facts show something different. In a technical legal sense, it was a prosecution, but it was not a persecution at all. And not even so much a prosecution as a test case. Crutch, who was sharply critical of the anti-evolution law, put it nicely. He wrote, "It was a strange sort of witch trial, one in which the accused won a scholarship enabling him to attend graduate school, and the only victim was Assistant Prosecuting Attorney William Jennings Bryan. That's crutch. The scientists who went to Dayton in order to testify on behalf of the Scopes trial raised a scholarship fund to enable Scopes to pursue graduate study in the field and at the institution of his choice. Scopes thought seriously of law, but in the end decided on geology, which he studied at the University of Chicago. Bryan, who was eloquent as an orator, suffered in the eyes of most humiliation at the hands of defense attorney Clarence Darrow when Bryan agreed to testify about the teachings of the Bible on the witness stand. Neither Darrow nor Bryan were particularly nuanced thinkers, but Darrow was quicker on his feet and had the advantage of getting to ask the questions rather than having to answer them. In addition, the heat of Dayton's midsummer days and the strain of the trial may well have been the immediate cause of Bryan's death just 5 days after the end of the trial. Crutch might have added that it was a strange sort of witch trial in which the defendant had to persuade the prosecution's witnesses to testify, in which the prosecutor offered to pay the defendant's fine, and after which the defendant was offered a renewal of his teaching contract, but all of that happened at Dayton, too. Among the initiators of the trial, one can distinguish two very different, though not incompatible, motives. Some of those who took part in setting the case up were opposed to Tennessee's new anti-evolution law and wanted to challenge the act's constitutionality. Others were civic boosters who hoped that Dayton's hosting of that test case would bring some notice and maybe some business to a city facing hard economic times. The case originated with three events. The first was Tennessee's passage of the Butler Act, an act, according to its long title, prohibiting the teaching of evolution theory in the public schools. Early in 1925, farmer and part-time legislator John Washington Butler, motivated by concern that teaching students a theory of the animal ancestry of man caused them to lose their faith in God, wrote, and the legislature passed, a bill making it unlawful for any teacher in the public schools of the state to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man is descended from a lower order of animals. The second event was a decision by the newly formed American Civil Liberties Union to challenge the constitutionality of the law. To do this, it needed to find someone with standing to bring the matter into the courts. A school teacher would be best situated for that role, and to find one, the union distributed in the newspapers of Tennessee an article announcing, we're looking for a Tennessee teacher who is willing to accept our services in testing the law in the courts. Our lawyers think a friendly test case can be arranged without costing a teacher his or her job. Distinguished counsel have volunteered their services. All we need now is a willing defendant. The third was a response to that announcement by George Rapelier, a young New Yorker with a doctorate in chemical engineering, then working in Dayton. Rapelier saw the announcement in the Chattanooga Times just a few days after Dayton's school year had ended, and decided it would be good for Dayton to host such a test case. The next day, he went to work to secure the honor of hosting the trial for his city. He first succeeded in persuading some of his fellow citizens, including F.E. Robinson, the chairman of the school board, and Walter White, superintendent of the schools. They're all featured there. That hosting the trial would be good for the town. Some of those citizens favored the law. Rapelier did not. Both sides, however, agreed that hosting the trial would be good for Dayton. So Rapelier went in search of a teacher willing to stand as defendant. The logical choice, of course, would have been the biology teacher, W.F. Ferguson. But Ferguson, who was also principal of the school, had a family to support and decided not to get involved. Second choice was John T. Scopes, who had just finished his first year teaching physics and mathematics at the high school, but who had substituted in Ferguson's biology class during that teacher's illness. Scopes was invited to meet with Rapelier and the others at Robinson's drugstore. That's where the post picture comes from, which served as a kind of social center for the town. Rapelier began by asking Scopes whether it was possible to teach biology without teaching evolution. Scopes said it was not, And to make his point, pulled a copy of George William Hunter's Civic Biology, the state-mandated textbook, off the shelf. Robinson's drugstore sold textbooks on the side. The book placed man in an evolutionary series along with all other organisms, although Hunter emphasized that man is separated mentally by a wide gap from all other animals. Would Scopes be willing to challenge the law? Scopes was not certain that he had actually taught the passages that discussed evolution during Ferguson's illness at all. But since he'd used the book to help the students review for their final examinations, all present thought that a case could be against him could be made. Scopes, who had been a student at the University of Kentucky just 3 years before, when university president Frank McVeigh had led the successful fight against an anti-evolution law in that state, consented. "If you can prove that I've taught evolution, then I qualify as a defendant," Scopes said. Robinson then called the city desk of the Chattanooga Times. "This is Effie Robinson in Dayton. I'm chairman of the school board here. We've just arrested a man for teaching evolution." Then Scopes went back to the high school to finish the tennis game that had been interrupted by the invitation to come down to the drugstore. Rappelier notified the ACLU. Although local lawyers could have handled the prosecution of the case, and the ACLU had already offered to provide lawyers for the defense, several other lawyers quickly became involved in the case. Their identities and their concerns and their motives reveal much about the nature of what happened to Dayton on those hot summer days of 1925. A goal of the city being to host an event that would attract some notice, it was perhaps only natural that the prosecution would invite William Jennings Bryan to come to their assistance, which he promptly agreed to do. Bryan, now the great commoner rather than the boy orator of the Platte, had been active in the Democratic Party politics since his election to Congress in 1890. Three times nominated by his party for the presidency, Secretary of State in the Wilson administration until Wilson's bellicose response to the sinking of the Lusitania precipitated his resignation, Bryan had been a tireless advocate for many of the progressive causes of his day: Philippine independence, the direct election of senators, women's suffrage, income tax, legislation by initiative and referendum. He had also been a regular and popular speaker on the Chautauqua circuit. The anti-evolution crusade of the 1920s, which he was largely, though not exclusively, responsible for launching, was to be his last campaign. Bryan's announcement that he would participate in the prosecution of Scopes prompted Clarence Darrow and Dudley Steele Malone to volunteer for Scopes' defense. Darrow had gained national fame, or perhaps notoriety, representing defendants in at least two crimes of the century already, in a century not yet 3 decades old. The first of these was the trial of labor leader Big Bill Haywood, charged with complicity in the assassination of Idaho Governor Frank Steunenberg in 1905. In the years between his acquittal in the Steunenberg case and the Scopes trial, Haywood had been convicted of violating the Espionage Act of 1917 for calling a strike during wartime, and had fled to Soviet Russia. The second of these trials of the century was the trial of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, two brilliant and rich Chicago college students who had killed a young neighbor in an unsuccessful attempt to prove that they could commit a perfect crime. Darrow came to Dayton within a year of arguing before a Chicago judge in mitigation of the latter offense, the defendants having pled guilty, that the killers could not be held responsible for their actions. His efforts saved them both from execution, but Darrow's denial of the doctrine of free will and his public defense of agnosticism in other contexts had gained him as much notoriety in some circles as he'd gained renown in others. Scopes was the only case in which Darrow ever volunteered his services. Malone, a friend of Darrow, was a prominent New York divorce lawyer and a divorced Catholic who continued to hold broadly Christian theological views. The ACLU would never have chosen Darrow, whose iconoclastic views on religion and human psychology would have distracted, I did distract, you might say, from the narrow constitutional focus that the union preferred. But Scopes was a defendant, so the choice was his. Representing the ACLU then was Arthur Garfield Hayes, one of its founders. Hayes' later career provides his character note. He defended the right of workers to organize unions and the right of Henry Ford to distribute any Union literature to his workers. Though Hayes was himself Jewish, he traveled to Berlin on behalf of the defendants of the Reichstag fire trial and defended the right of the pro-Nazi German-American Bund to possess anti-Semitic literature. Hayes' view of the Scopes trial, expressed later, was that it was a battle between two definite types of mind, the rigid, orthodox, unyielding, narrow, conventional mind, and the broad, liberal, critical, cynical, and tolerant mind. The city welcomed all these men. Bryan was cheered when he spoke at the trial, but defense lawyers, Darrow, but especially the lesser-known Malone, were given even more spirited applause when they spoke. When objection was made that the prayers with which the court opened each day had a uniformly fundamentalist and argumentative, one defense lawyer complained, tone, the judge, John T. Ralston, turned the matter over to the Dayton Pastors Association, which arranged an alternation between fundamentalist and modernist ministers for the remaining days of the trial. Crutch wrote in a retrospective article 40 years later, the little town of Dayton behaved on the whole very well, though ostensibly, at least, all on the side of the prosecution. Many of the businessmen were finally delighted that their town was going to be put on the map as a place where one of the greatest questions of the day would be debated by world-famous visitors. The state's view of the case was put by prosecution attorney Ben McKenzie as this. There's but one issue before the court and jury, and that is, did the defendant violate the statute? The statute interprets itself. The defense strategy, according to Hayes, was based upon three propositions. First, that the law was unconstitutional because it attempted to make the Bible the test of truth. Second, that the law was unconstitutional because, in light of present-day knowledge of evolution, to be deduced from scientists, it was unreasonable. And third, that the evidence of students of the Bible would show not only that there was no inconsistency between acceptance of evolution of man and of the Bible, but would also show that the law was indefinite as well as unreasonable because no two persons understood the Bible alike. The defense admitted that everything the prosecution witnesses said about what Scopes had done was true. It had planned to build its defense around expert testimony in support of the second and third points mentioned above, and it invited to Dayton for that purpose 11 scientists and biblical scholars on whom it intended to base its claim that the Butler Act constituted an unreasonable use of the police power. The only one of those experts actually permitted to testify was zoologist Maynard Metcalf, who earned a PhD here at Johns Hopkins University in 1893, and had just accepted a research appointment at that university when he was invited to testify at the trial. He was active, for example, as a Bible teacher in the Congregational Church, which was surely partly responsible for the decision to invite precisely him to testify. To the use of expert testimony, however, the prosecution objected and was sustained, though the judge did allow the defense attorneys to read into the trial record as an offer of proof for consideration by the appellate court statements from those experts about the testimony they would have given. The only other expert witness allowed to testify was Bryan, whom the defense called as an expert on the Bible. This is what led to Darrow's famous cross-examination of Bryan, an examination so mean-spirited that it evoked sharp protests even from the law's opponents. To this, too, District Attorney General Tom Stewart had objected that Bryan's eagerness to testify to the content of, or perhaps rather to bear witness to the truth of, the book of Genesis, combined perhaps with Judge Ralston's natural human eagerness to see the exchange, overcame the judge's bitter legal judgment, and Darrow's examination of Bryan was allowed to proceed, though it was next day stricken from the record. We still have a copy of it, but it was stricken from the legal record in a technical sense. Their expert testimony being excluded, the defense had little left to do. Judge Ralston, having upheld the constitutionality of the Butler Act, a conviction was necessary to the attainment of the larger goals of Scopes and his attorneys. If Scopes were acquitted, their day in court would come to an end with the law still on the books. Indeed, the New York World had exaggerated only slightly when, before the trial began, it had written, upon Mr. Darrow is placed the responsibility of losing the case. Should Mr. Scopes be acquitted, All the plans for testing the law of Tennessee in the state and in the United States Supreme Courts would have been for nothing. It would have been necessary then to obtain a new defendant and lose his case. Darrow told the jury that on the evidence provided, they had no choice but to find the defendant guilty. After 9 minutes of deliberation, the jury returned a guilty verdict, as the evidence required that they do. The judge imposed the minimum penalty authorized by the Butler Act, a fine of $100, which was paid by the Baltimore Sun. Look at Baltimore again. Look at it one more time. Our appeal to the state's Supreme, on appeal to the state's Supreme Court, on appeal, the state Supreme Court upheld the act as a declaration of a master as to the character of work the master servant shall or rather shall not perform. Judge Colin P. McKinney, in a short lone dissent, would have stricken the statute down for uncertainty of meaning. McKinney did not elaborate, but it's not hard, not anything is instructive to see the problem. What was the exact meaning of the sententia prohibita? Could one teach animal descent as long as one did not deny the scriptural account? The general idea that the human race arose as a result of the evolutionary transformation of prehuman animal species covers a range of more particular views, which I've tried to block out here. Natural processes on one extreme, this is a view on one extreme, produce, without divine intervention or guidance, the first human beings from animal species. Or maybe just produced, guided by divine action, but natural processes produced, guided by divine action, the first human beings from animal species. Or maybe they just produced the bodies of the first human beings from animal species. Or maybe natural processes didn't produce by themselves, but only played a significant role, supplemented by divine action, the bodies of the first human beings. There's a whole array of those. Which ones were prohibited by the law? Which ones were prohibited? If I'm a teacher in a Tennessee school, does the law tell me what I can teach and what I can't? It doesn't, we might say. McKinney said, anyway. The law has to fall. A1, I think, probably was prohibited. But about the others, I think there's much less clarity. To take a concrete example, not from philosophical theorizing. I'm a philosopher, so that's the kind of way I do things. As a historian, we might say, no, let's look at what was actually found in the textbook. So I did that too. Truman J. Moon's Biology for Beginners asserted that not only man, but all living things, both plant and animal, are not only related, but actually descended from common ancestors. But it also said evolution does not teach that God can be left out of the scheme of creation. Rest assured that the minds of the great scientists and philosophers, or in their minds, there's no conflict between the conclusion of science and religion. Did Moon's textbook, the teaching that, constitute a denial of the story of divine creation of man as taught in the Bible? The court went on, however, to overturn Scope's conviction on the grounds of the $100 fine had been imposed by the judge rather than by the jury as required for such a large fine by the Tennessee Constitution. The court suggested further that the Attorney General drop the case, which he did. The Butler Act, along with Bryan laws similar anti-evolution laws in other states inspired by Bryan's campaign, subsequently passed by Mississippi and Arkansas, remained on the books for some 40 years. In 1965, they were challenged by Susan Epperson, a biology teacher teaching at Little Rock Central High School, the same school, as it happens, where the 101st Airborne Division had enforced federal integration law at Bayonet Point less than a decade before. So the school comes back, but here in a little less noisy way, we might say. Anyway, in 1968, the U.S. Supreme Court declared these laws unconstitutional. So there, briefly, is the history of what happened at Dayton. Now I want to talk about the Supreme Court and Scopes case and the warfare myth. What does this case show us about the relation between science and religion? The case was in fact a conglomerate of several simultaneous confrontations of various degrees of relevance to the question of the historical relations between science and religion. Some were clearly not part of any warfare between science and religion. They must be identified and set aside. The first, of course, is the confrontation between prosecutor and defense attorney. That's an inherent feature of America's adversarial system of justice. The second was a struggle between two political philosophies, William Jennings Bryan's commitment to majority rule and the American Civil Liberties Union's commitment to libertarianism. A third confrontation had its origin in Clarence Darrow's hostility to religion. This was, to be sure, a confrontation with religion, but not science's confrontation with religion. That leaves us with two confrontations to examine. One was the political confrontation under the Bryan laws between two different views of what constitutes improper or at least un-American government educational policy on matters affecting or affected by religion. Defenders of the Bryan laws argued that the laws were necessary to ensure government neutrality on religious matters. Bryan had said, if the Bible cannot be defended in the schools, it should not be attacked either directly or under the guise of philosophy or science. A political advertisement in the Arkansas Gazette, as voters in that state faced a referendum on the Bryan law, said simply, it, that is the state's proposed law, does not seek to help the church. It simply forbids the state attacking the church by having evolution taught in the schools at the taxpayers' expense. Journalist Walter Lippmann, who opposed the laws, recognized the importance of this principle and gave Bryan his Jeffersonian due. He wrote, Bryan asked whether, if it's wrong to compel people to support a creed they disbelieve, it's not also wrong to compel them to support teaching which impugns the creed in which they do believe. Jefferson had insisted, he's referring to the bill for establishing religious freedom, which Jefferson had sponsored in 1779, Jefferson had insisted that the people should not have to pay for teaching of Anglicanism. Mr. Bryan asked why they should be made for the teaching of agnosticism. Opponents generally agreed that the law constituted impermissible deference to a particular set of religious beliefs. Maynard Shipley, who wrote on this topic in a few years later, wrote, fundamentalist religious dogmas are being set up as a bar to freedom of teaching in our legally secular schools. Tennessee's Butler Act was particularly vulnerable in this count as it made specific reference to the Bible. The two later Bryan laws enacted in Mississippi and in Arkansas then did not do so. Still, the issue bore no essential connection to the relation between science and religion. One of the defense attorneys later said, the issue with Dayton was not fundamentalism against modernism. It was not faith against agnosticism. It was not science against religion. The issue was and is this, shall the constitutional guarantee of religious freedom and complete separation of church and state be violated or narrowed? Final confrontation suggested in the Butler Act with its opposition between the theory of descent of man from a lower order of animals and the story of divine creation of man as taught in the Bible has the greatest appearance of being a struggle between science and religion. I'll argue, however, in even that characterization of what happened at Dayton distorts our understanding of the historical relation between science and religion. No one can deny that the campaign Bryan launched was a war against evolution, at least as applied to human origins, but who are the belligerents? Not, I want to argue, religion and science. Not religion? First, although Bryan and his allies had religious motives, they cannot be identified with religion, not with Christianity, nor even with conservative Protestantism. To see how mistaken such an identification is, we need to take a look at what Christians were thinking and saying about evolution, particularly during the 1920s. Let's leave aside those branches of Christianity most willing to abandon traditional theological views in favor of new currents of thought, and look at more conservative Christian theologies. First at Catholicism and then at conservative Protestantism. What do they think and say about evolution in general, about anthropogenesis, and about the Bryan laws themselves? Catholics had been exploring the compatibility of the theory of evolution both in general and in its application to human origin since the beginning of the 19th century. I have explored this in detail in my recently completed book, Accommodating Evolution, Catholicism and Science, 1831 to 1950, which is now under review at a publisher. We can find a brief but fairly standard articulation of Catholic thought on our subject in an article published by Father Ulrich Hauber, a biologist at and later president of St. Ambrose College in Davenport, Iowa. The articles published in the Ecclesiastical Review in 1921. He wrote, "The evolutionist believes that the whole class of animals we call birds, for example, descended or developed from a simple ancestor in a natural fashion. Once accepted as a tentative working basis, everything seems to fall in line with the theory. Those who are fearful as such a doctrine is incompatible with Scripture and Revelation will do well to read carefully the first chapter of Genesis and to consult the reflections of St. Augustine and St. Gregory of Nyssa." He was not willing, in the absence of more fossil evidence than the half dozen bones that had been found by 1920 in Java and at Heidelberg, to extend the theory to anthropogenesis, the origin of man. But he reminded his readers that the Church does not condemn the proposition that in fashioning man's body to become a fit habitation for the soul, God made use of natural laws, acknowledging, however, that the best one can say is that it's barely tolerated. He added that we do not like the idea of brute ancestors. Of course not. Did you ever see a two-month-old human embryo? Did it appeal to your sense of propriety that you were once such a creature? His most interesting remark is perhaps the final one. The ground must be prepared before such novel ideas can be sowed broadcast. But that ground is prepared, before that ground is prepared, we shall need a 20th century St. Thomas, one who can so combine sacred and profane learning that both will draw benefit therefrom. One, perhaps, who can make Darwin and Huxley become to modern Catholic thought what Aristotle and Avicenna were to the Scholastics. So underlying work like that of Hauber was the theology of nature, which his contemporary Belgian priest theologian Henri de Darladon had called Christian naturalism, and defined as the tendency to attribute to natural action of secondary causes all that is not excluded therefrom, either by reason or the positive data of the natural sciences, and to have recourse to a special divine intervention distinct from God's general governing activity only if it's absolutely necessary to do so. This theology of nature was, in general, a well-established principle of Catholic thought, though its application to the evolution of man in particular was still controversial among Catholics in the 1920s. As the Scopes trial approached, Hauber took the opportunity to restate what he'd said earlier, this time in a pamphlet entitled Catholic Opinion on the Evolution Controversy. Here his phrasing was perhaps slightly more accommodating of evolutionary anthropogenesis. The body, indeed, may have evolved. That's a scientific problem waiting for data for it towards its solution. Indeed, by the end of the 19th century, three distinct positions on evolution and anthropogenesis had emerged in Catholic thought. Some theologians simply rejected the idea. Pietro Catarini, a Jesuit, in the pages of Civiltà Cattolica, and then in his book on the origin of man according to transformism, published in 1884, and declared it a matter of revealed doctrine that the first parents of the human race, not only with respect to the body, but also with respect to the soul, were produced by the immediate action of God. Other Catholics disagreed. A second view, evolution of the first human body, but direct creation of the first, as of every human soul, had been defended by English Catholic anatomist St. George Jackson. Remember? It was not really, not officially a saint. That was what name his parents gave him at the baptismal certificate. So maybe he's a saint, but I mean, Congregation of Causes didn't declare that. Anyway, in his book on the Genesis of Species, He defended this as early as 1871. He was shortly thereafter awarded a doctorate by Blessed Pius IX, though in the 1890s, the Congregation for the Index of Prohibited Books told two later defenders of that thesis, French Dominican M.D. Leroy and American Holy Cross priest John Zahm, to withdraw their books from circulation. This position was, however, later given explicit toleration by Pope Pius XII in Humani Generis, and seems to have been endorsed by St. John Paul II in his 1996 address to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. An intermediate view was articulated by the Spanish Dominican philosopher and former primate of Spain, Ceferino Cardinal González, in his book on the Bible and Science, published in 1892, where he said the possibility that causes or agents other than God intervened in the preliminary preparation of Adam's body up to an imperfect stage of development, reserving the final stages of its preparation to receive a rational soul to divine action, the direct and immediate action of God in the formation of the body of the first man, being action which traditional biblical exegesis seems to require. The view was shortly thereafter defended by another Spanish Dominican, Juan González Rentero, in his book on evolution and Christian philosophy, published in 1898. So there you got two versions of Catholic evolutionism as applied to the human body. Haber's view on evolutionary anthropogenesis seems to have been more open to a role for evolutionary processes in anthropogenesis than Butler and his fellow legislators had been. But with respect to the trial itself, American Catholics generally kept their distance from both sides of the controversy. The editors of Commonweal, a lay Catholic review then in its second year of publication, wrote, "The Commonweal considers that the Dayton case is hardly likely to advance genuine knowledge of this highly complex and technical matter, but is very likely to confuse the real issue involved through the stirring up of a raucous and heated debate between such emotional extremists as Mr. W.J. Bryan and Mr. Clarence Darrow, to the accompaniment of the jazz band to be installed in Dayton's baseball field among the batteries of radio machines and newspaper cameras." The Jesuit journal America summed the trial up in this way: "It was no more than an episode in the struggle between a party that wishes to establish Protestant fundamentalism as a state religion and another impersonated by Clarence Darrow that aims at no less than an overturn of all Christianity. For that reason, moderates of all kind were well justified in saying, 'You're both wrong, a plague on both your houses.'" So that was America. Catholic neutrality was noted by outside observers as well. We have one more local reference. Baltimore Sun's H.L. Mencken, no greater friend of Catholicism than of religion generally, wrote, "The current discussion of the Tennessee buffoonery and the Catholic and other authoritarian press," Mencken, in case you don't know him, is excitable in his ways of writing. Anyway, so the current buffoonery in the Catholic and other authoritarian press is immensely more free and intelligent than it is in the evangelical Protestant press. In such journals as the Commonweal, the New Catholic Weekly, both sides were set forth and the varying contentions were subjected to frank and untrammeled criticism. The Canon de Durlado whoops it up for evolution. Dr. O'Toole denounces it as nonsense. The Commonweal itself takes no sides, but argues that evolution ought to be taught in the schools, not as an incontrovertible fact, but as an hypothesis accepted by the overwhelming majority of enlightened men. The objections to it, theological and evidential, should be noted, but not represented as unanswerable. So, that's Mencken. The campaign for the Bryan Laws, I say, was, to be sure, launched by conservative Protestants, but such Protestants could be found on both sides of the issue. While Presbyterian Bryan led the anti-evolution campaign, John Gresham Machen, one of conservative Presbyterianism's leading theologians, turned down Bryan's invitation to testify for the prosecution, that is, for the defense of the, that is, in defense of the law, at the Scopes trial. And he, Watson Smith, pastor of Little Rock Second Presbyterian Church, worked and preached against the passage of the Bryan Law in Arkansas. While Baptist William Bell Riley and J.W. Porter, promoted bylaws, Edward Young Mullins, president of the Southern Baptist Convention, worked against them. While it was primitive Baptist John Washington Butler who wrote Tennessee's anti-evolution law, it was another primitive Baptist, Bryce Cundiff, who had cast the dramatic deciding vote against Kentucky's Bryan Law in that state's House of Representatives. Conservative Protestant opposition to the Bryan Laws and the broader themes of the campaign against evolution had various grounds. Some conservative Protestants were evolutionists in some sense of the term. Others, without maintaining the truth of the theory, at least rejected the idea that it was necessarily incompatible with Christian doctrine. Still others, including incompatibilists, opposed the laws on separationist grounds. The relatively strong version of the separation of church and state has traditionally had an important place in Baptist political philosophy. And some Baptists, Mullins is a leading example, thought the principles told against the anti-evolution bills. Although Protestant colleges and universities fell outside the scope of the Bryan Laws, what happened at such institutions does help to show that this was not precisely a war between religion and science. The theory of evolution was taught at some denominational colleges, including Baptist Wake Forest, Presbyterian Worcester. Others, for example, Baptist Baylor, remained battlegrounds. It's undeniable that the passage of Bryan Laws was a project grounded in the religious beliefs of the campaigners and their supporters. What is deniable is that it was precisely Bryan, Riley, and Porter, rather than, say, Smith, Mullins, Worcester College President Charles Wishart, or Wake Forest College President William Lewis Poteet, not to mention Father Harper, who constitute religion's contribution to the fight between evolutionists and anti-evolutionists. If the first objection to the claim that the anti-evolution campaign in the 1920s was a war of religion against science, there's a war of religion against science, is a mischaracterization of one belligerent in its mischaracterization of one belligerent as religion. The second is that it's somewhat mischaracterization of the idea against which you're waging. That is, that it was science that they were fighting against. The anti-evolution laws were directed to the public, at the public schools. What were they in fact saying about evolution and the origin of the human race in the period in question? No doubt, teachers varied both in their views about evolution and in their approach to the subject. The various observers, and not just determined anti-evolutionists, recognized a problem. Father Haber acknowledged that the concerns that had led Tennessee to pass the Wetler Act. He wrote, "German Darwinist Ernst Haeckel boldly proclaims that the theory of evolution leaves no room for faith in the existence of God, the freedom of the will, or the immortality of the soul. No wonder the whole theory has a bad reputation. We're asked by such false philosophers as Haeckel, along with Herbert Spencer and T.H. Huxley, to give up all of our most sacred convictions, belief in God, future life, personal responsibility. And what are we offered in their place? Blind forces and brute ancestry. That's why the anti-evolutionists justly fear and rightly condemn. That is, those philosophical views that were being associated with evolution. If this is the kind of evolutionary teaching that Tennessee has banned, Catholics have no choice of sides in the controversy. It's a doctrine hostile to all religion, and surely public schools may not teach it." Howard K. Beale, who made a study of freedom of teaching in the 1930s and was not particularly, or was not at all, I think, any evolutionist, wrote, "One basic cause of fundamentalist attacks on the schools is the fact that hundreds of poorly trained teachers of science, with a desire to shock people with their new information and no adequate training in their subject, have been sent out into the schools with exactly the attitude that science is a body of indisputably proved facts." Underlying the controversy between the proponents of the Bryan Laws and their critics lies a real dilemma. It's possible to address the origins of man without mentioning the existence and origin of the human soul. Or is it? The question of the origin of the human race, offensive to scientific ears as it may be, to say so, is not a purely scientific matter. For those who hold a materialist anthropology, the question of the origins of man will be no less a scientific issue than is the question of the origin of butterflies in slime mold. But the soundness of the materialist anthropology, which that anthropology presupposes, is not itself a purely scientific issue. For Christians and for others whose anthropology includes the thesis that man has an immaterial soul, the origin of which cannot be established by scientific methods, a complete account of the origin of man would be beyond the reach of science. Make a couple of remarks about the significance of the case by way of conclusion. What can we learn from a careful look at the Scopes trial? Two things, I think. The first is that the idea that there is a war between science and religion causes us to misunderstand history. It doesn't just oversimplify history, it distorts it. There were larger wars underlying the Scopes trial, but to say that science and religion were the belligerents is simply incorrect. There were, I think, two underlying wars. The first was a war between evolutionists and anti-evolutionists, even within conservative Christian churches. The second was one between militant atheists wearing laboratory coats as a kind of camouflage and Christians. What is true of the Scopes case is, I think, to a certain extent, applicable to other alleged cases of wars between religion and science. Single lecture gives time to show this in just one case. I address several others in my book, The War that Never Was. You can find a discussion of other cases in books like Galileo Goes to Jail and a number of others. There's a lot of good books on the subject. If somebody's interested, send me a note. I can send you a list of things to read when you're finished with your studies and have time for such things. Second, the unwillingness to accommodate those with whom we disagree leads to deep and prolonged social conflict. Ryan's anti-evolutionism was less radical than is the anti-evolutionism of today. He sought to keep evolutionary anthropogenesis out of the public schools. In the last 50 years, anti-evolutionism has broadened into a comprehensive attack on natural selection, that is, on contemporary evolutionary biology in general, in the case of intelligent design theory, and on all of what I call the paleo-etiological sciences, cosmogony, historical geology, as well as evolutionary biology, in the case of creation science. The Butler Act, that was the direct object of Scopes' challenge, had its defects as a piece of legislation. But we should acknowledge, as too much contemporary discourse does not, both the complexity of the issue and the moral, if not constitutional, importance of doing our best to accommodate religious dissenters in our community, even when we're certain that they're mistaken. That, I think, can be done without compromising science education by adhering to several principles in public school education. So, the propriety of teaching students what the scientific consensus is. Second, the fallibility of science. Third, the appropriateness of a policy of neutrality about both what religion teaches and how to resolve any perceived tensions between religious doctrine and the scientific consensus. Well, I say that just as way, by way of suggestion, is it to say, you might be back to go no talk on that. I mean, you could spend a whole, you know, lecture just on how to spell those things out, but I just want to suggest that it is possible to teach good science in a way that accommodates the concerns of anti-evolutionists. I think they're mistaken, but I think we have enough fights to do in our culture without adding one that can be avoided. Well, anyway, that's what I prepared to say. I have time for questions if you do. I know everybody has class schedules and so on, but if you want to ask questions, I'll be glad to answer them either to the group or individually. I don't hear it real well, and if you take this microphone and just hold it as you talk, it'll send a signal to my hearing aid. So anyway, thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.